From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! With the acquittal of President Clinton, where do we go from here? We'll look at sexual harassment law and progressive politics. Also, gun makers under fire after a Brooklyn jury finds 15 gun manufacturers liable for shootings committed with illegally obtained guns. We'll take a look at how gun makers have flooded the market with lethal weapons. And as gun regulation moves from the legislatures to the courts, can the NRA be outsmarted in the courtroom? All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Yesterday, the body of the 22-year-old West African immigrant, Ahmed Amadou Diallo, began his way from New York City to his native Guinea on a Continental Airlines jet bound for Paris, accompanied by his grieving parents. Thousands of people and hundreds of cars, trucks and taxis, jalopies and shiny Mercedes-Benzes escorted Amadou's plane coffin and his family to the airport in a show of protest and support. Four white plainclothes police officers from an elite unit whose motto is, "We own the night," fired 19 bullets into Diallo as he stood in the vestibule of his apartment house in the Bronx borough on February 4th. Many have questioned why so many shots were fired. There is still yet to be a story presented by the police department in their defense. The officers have been placed on administrative non-enforcement duty, although they still carry their weapons and badges. The shooting is being investigated by the Bronx District Attorney's Office with the assistance of the FBI. Meanwhile, people around the city are calling for the federal government to launch an investigation into systematic police brutality throughout New York City. This news from Oregon. Salvage crews will try again today to burn the rest of the fuel and oil on board the wreck of a freighter grounded off the Oregon coast. An estimated 50,000 gallons of fuel remains on the broken cargo ship. The Japanese-owned freighter had 400,000 gallons on board when it ran aground. 3 days after the ship was initially set on fire, several attempts were made yesterday to reignite the remaining fuel. A Coast Guard helicopter dropped loads of burning petroleum jelly into a cargo hold. The ship burned for about an hour, sending a huge column of black smoke into the air. Trade and drugs top the agenda at President Clinton's, holding a quick summit today with Mexico's president. The meeting with Ernesto Zedillo is taking place at a cattle ranch-turned-luxury hotel on the Yucatan Peninsula near the city of Mérida. Afterward, Clinton is expected to announce $4 billion in new loan guarantees to encourage American exports south of the border. But much of today's session will focus on stopping the drug trade. In 2 weeks, Clinton must tell Congress whether Mexico is doing its part and can qualify for continued U.S. aid. Critics in Congress say corruption is rife and are expected to challenge any decision to recertify Mexico. American Airlines says it could be back on its feet by the end of the week. Pilots began returning to work yesterday following a massive sick-out at the nation's second-largest airline. The mass return followed a judge's contempt order against the pilots' union and two of its top officials. More than 500,000 travelers have been left at the gate by the nation's second-largest airline because of a large number of pilots calling in sick. The pilots' dispute with American is over how quickly American should integrate pilots from recently purchased Reno Air into its own roster. The American Airlines pilots also objected to lower salaries for the Reno Air pilots. In other union news, members of one of the six union locals that struck Detroit's daily newspapers for 19 months approved a contract yesterday. The agreement covers 98 members of Local 18 of the International Typographers Union. And Sean Ellis, a spokesperson, this according to Sean Ellis, a spokesperson for the Metropolitan Council of Newspaper Unions. The agreement is the first reach between the newspapers and one of the formerly striking unions since the walkout began in 1995. Members of the local create advertisements and prepare advertising and news materials for publication. Delegates from about 170 nations are meeting this week to complete an international biotechnology safety treaty that the United States government and many American companies fear could greatly restrict exports of food and other products made using genetic engineering. The biosafety protocol, which is being negotiated this week in Cartagena, Colombia, would require that exports of genetically modified organisms be approved in advance by the importing country. The negotiations are an outgrowth of the Convention on Biological Diversity, drawn up at the Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro in 1992. They're being held because of concern about the release of genetically modified plants and animals into the environment. The Justice Department closed the books this month on a $1.6 billion reparations program for tens of thousands of people of Japanese descent who lived in the United States during World War II and were interned in relocation camps. The department will now settle with 181 people of Japanese descent who were removed from Latin America and suffered similar treatment. And that's some of the news. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Republicans are attempting to regroup after the Senate acquittal last week of President Clinton. A group of Republican leaders in Florida warned the party must broaden its appeal, recapture its agenda, isolate its right wing if it expects to recover from immense political damage it did to itself by pursuing the president's impeachment. Meanwhile, most Americans approve of the Senate votes not to remove President Clinton from office, but blame him for the impeachment trial and remain divided over what, if anything, should happen next. This, according to a new Washington Post survey. A majority say the Senate should end attempts to censure or formally reprimand Clinton, but nearly half also believe the president eventually should have to face criminal perjury or obstruction of justice charges, either while he's still in office or after he leaves in January of the year 2001. Well, today we're going to take a look at what the Senate impeachment trial has meant for women's rights and civil rights. Much was said about both during the trial. Republican House managers heralded themselves as the protectors of women facing sexual harassment and as champions for civil rights, while President Clinton has asked for forgiveness in black churches, and also key feminists were among President Clinton's fiercest defenders. We're joined right now by three people to talk about a variety of issues, among them Gwendolyn Mink. She's author of Welfare's End and a forthcoming book on sexual harassment. She's a professor of politics at the University of California at Santa Cruz. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor Mink.
Good morning.
Well, what are your thoughts today? Friday, the Senate impeachment trial not only acquitted President Clinton on the charges of perjury and obstruction of justice, but the Republican House managers did not succeed in getting a majority in either of the counts, not to mention the two-thirds that would have been necessary for conviction. Tell us your thoughts today.
Well, I think we sort of basically knew the outcome, long before it actually happened, although we did not know what the margin would be or the fact that they wouldn't be able to get a majority on either of the two counts. I'm not sure all of that matters so much anymore. It's sort of water under the bridge. What concerns me is the lingering effects of the politics of the past year as it's played out on the terrain of sexual harassment and sexual matters, and how that politics will feed into a potential backlash and chilling effect in the future.
Well, why don't we talk about that? First of all, I think people probably don't even understand what sexual harassment laws are that were passed by Congress.
Actually, Congress never passed any sexual harassment laws. Sexual harassment is is a problem of discrimination or a form of discrimination that courts have recognized under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Courts began to recognize the problem in the late 70s, culminating in 1986 with the first Supreme Court ruling on the subject in a case, Meritor Savings Bank versus Vinson. The Congress, the only time the Congress has ever spoken about sexual harassment was in anticipation of the Civil Rights Act of 1991, which was a point at which the Congress amended the 64 Act to permit sex discrimination plaintiffs to claim monetary damages, compensatory and punitive, if they prove discrimination. And in that context, the Congress did take testimony from sexual harassment targets. However, the Congress has never defined sexual harassment, and there is no sort of standing statutory authority on how the problem is to be dealt with.
Do you think that needs to be done? Do you think Congress should deal with it in some way?
I'm afraid, actually, that after all that has transpired in the past year, that Congress may well decide that it's time to do something, and the something that it's going to do will be to curtail the advancement in the law that women plaintiffs and feminist legal advocates have won over the last 20 years.
How would they do that?
Well, they could do that in several ways. They could amend the federal rules of evidence to prevent in asking defendants about pattern and practice issues in sexual harassment, pattern and practice being the line of questioning that Paula Jones had been engaged in when the Monica Lewinsky evidence turned up. They could, if Congress were to interfere by changing the rules of evidence to either diminish the likelihood of those sorts of questions or to prohibit them, that would be a very serious blow to many sexual harassment plaintiffs who are describing incidents that are he said, she said sorts of situations in which the formal authority of the defendant, usually the boss, is the harasser. You know, puts the plaintiff in a structurally disadvantaged position, and it's very hard for her to win credibility before judges and juries, let alone the public. And we know about women's credibility problem just from this last year with the systematic trashing of women every time they had a story to tell.
We're talking to Professor Gwendolyn Menk, professor of politics at University of California, Santa Cruz. Now, what about where the women's movement, the establishment, how they will be seen from here on in? I mean, you had a sort of unusual situation where the president has serious sexual harassment charges brought against him. In the end, leading feminists support him and say it's basically a right-wing coup against him. And a lot of the Republicans who were going after Clinton, they felt, were going after him precisely because of his position on issues like abortion. So you had a very complicated picture here. Professor Menk, where do you think the women's movement stands today? Do you think it lost stature and was shown to be hypocritical for not coming out in full support, for example, of Paula Jones? Or do you think people felt that it was an attempted coup against the president and the leading feminists were right to support Clinton?
Well, I think many people thought that a right-wing war was being conducted against the president, and many people will continue to think that. Some of those people who think that will excuse the women's movement for the position it took on the Clinton sexual harassment matter. The problem is, though, that the feminist advocates for the president engaged in this very syllogistic line of reasoning, which is that because the right wing is pointing out this problem, the problem in the leading to impeachment being the problem of potential perjury and obstruction of justice, therefore it must be an illegitimate issue. And unfortunately, the problem of whether or not a sexual harassment plaintiff has a scrupulously fair legal proceeding is a problem that continues to exist, so that to the extent that leading feminist spokespeople did not stand up for her right to a scrupulously fair legal proceeding by sort of brushing the perjury and obstruction justice charges under the rug as part of a right-wing coup, I think undermines their credibility in the future in arguing for legal reforms or legislative reforms that will strengthen the position of plaintiffs.
I wanted to turn now to Kevin Gray, who is author of a forthcoming book called The Death of Black Politics and is on the board of the National American Civil Liberties Union. Kevin Gray, what about the state of progressive politics today? President Clinton acquitted. The House managers did not get even a majority on either of the counts against him, let alone the two-thirds vote they needed for conviction. And the staunchest defenders of President Clinton, particularly in Congress, was the African-American Congressional Black Caucus, the African-American members. Your comments on this?
Well, I sure wish someone could define what progressive means to me these days, because I don't know if that word has any meaning anymore with Clintonism and with what has happened with President Clinton. A lot of things that we used to believe, a lot of principles that we used to believe, have been reduced to nothing. And I think that the support that the black community and specifically the black leadership has just been shameful in their support of Clinton, because Clinton has never been a civil rights president or civil rights politician from his time back in Arkansas to his time as candidate to his time as president. I mean, when did Bill Clinton become a civil rights president? It surely wasn't when he was expanding the war on drugs or when he was releasing Lonnie Guinier because she wanted to make a structural change in his society. I just think that the leadership's participation in watering down what civil rights means has been just appalling and shameful.
Where do you think we go from here?
Well, you know, I'm hoping that in the black community in particular, that new leadership arises that can pick up fighting the anti-black paradigm, and that's the paradigm that fights over the denial of equal protection or treatment or due process of law and equal opportunity, which is what the Paula Jones case was about when people invoke this whole idea of a civil rights lawsuit. It would appear to me that we should have been on the side of the person from the trailer park, so to speak. But, you know, hopefully new organizations will emerge out in the hinterlands and a new kind of paradigm will develop to challenge the old leadership. And maybe the future of black politics is right now is just reorganizing.
You've said that black politics is at an all-time low because of the leadership's alliance with President Clinton. You had Jesse Jackson leading the march in his support a day after President Clinton began the bombing of Iraq, which was hours before he was to be impeached. Where is the black leadership today?
Well, as I said, the black leadership took a walk on this, and I think they badly miseducated the black community, and they spread a mass ignorance about President Clinton in the black community. This whole idea of inviting Rosa Parks to the State of the Union or going to black churches or raising Dr. King's name, as Cheryl Mills has done, or even Reverend Jackson going to the steps of the Capitol to support a person as they bombed another country. And on that day that Reverend Jackson did that, I called the Rainbow and I asked, you know, is this the legacy of Dr. King? Would Dr. King support Lyndon Johnson as he engaged in Operation Rolling Thunder? This was surely not a civil rights legacy. But, you know, everybody is fighting to keep their place in the structure, in the Democratic Party structure, in the plantation structure. And Reverend has been the biggest drum major for staying on that plantation. And I managed Jesse Jackson's campaign here in South Carolina in 88, and I helped him organize the 209 marches in San Francisco. And I was with Reverend Jackson when Clinton made the comments about Sister Soldier. I was with Reverend Jackson when Bill Clinton called him a backstabber when he was campaigning for Tom Harkin. I was with Reverend Jackson when Bill Clinton went back to Arkansas to execute Ricky Ray Rector. And what bothers me is privately there has been a lot of talk about the politics of Bill Clinton, but publicly there has been this rush to be the first buddy or a rush to be as close to Clinton or to perpetuate the idea that Clinton is some kind of hero in the black community. And I think that has created a lot of confusion that in the future will damage the credibility of those black leaders who went out there and misdefined the meaning of civil rights.
Well, this is especially significant coming from you as one of the staunchest supporters of Jesse Jackson for many years. You've spent a lot of time with him traveling.
Well, I think he sold us out. I honestly think that he sold us out. Listen, Bill Clinton, this whole idea of a coup, and I heard that language come from Maxine Waters when she invoked the slave ancestry, or Toni Morrison when she started talking about Bill Clinton was as close to being a black president as we will ever get. They have really miseducated the black community on the meaning of civil rights, and to mean that all civil rights issues are just black, and they allowed Clinton to use this idea of civil rights meaning black to trump anything that the white trial managers could say, or to trump any white person's claim of the use of the word. And I just think that that's a dangerous thing to do. And because our movement is in such disarray at this point in history, and a lot of that is due to this whole notion of messianic leadership, I just think that Reverend leading that charge is leading to the further confusion that we are now facing in the black community as it relates to our politics.
Well, Kevin Gray, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. Kevin Gray, author of the forthcoming book, Death of Black Politics. Gwendolyn Mink, I want to thank you for having joined us, the professor of politics at University of California, Santa Cruz, who is writing a book on sexual harassment that will be called Hostile Environment. Thank you for being with us. And when we come back, we'll be joined by Kit Gage, who is with the National Coalition to Protect Political Freedom, about secrecy and secret evidence and how that related to the Clinton trial and what it'll mean for future trials and for freedom in this country. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Just to continue and wrap up the conversation about President Clinton, the impeachment trial, and where we go from here after this conversation, we're going to turn to some groundbreaking court proceedings that are taking place around the country, and that's lawsuits against gun makers on the same model as the lawsuits against the tobacco industry. But first, right now, we're joined by Kit Gage, who is the National Coordinator of the National Coalition to Protect Political Freedom. Kit Gage, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks, Amy.
Can you tell us about the whole issue of documents and secret documents, secret evidence, issues raised by the president's lawyers that it was fundamentally unfair that they were asked to defend him when they only got to see some of the testimony? First of all, can you explain that? What didn't they get to see? I don't think a lot of American people understood that. And then how do you think that relates to issues of secrecy today?
Well, I think people will remember all those dozens and dozens of boxes of material that went to the House of Representatives that all were pertaining to the impeachment process. That was all evidence. It was all the information, the evidence, the testimony, whatever, that the House of Representatives, that the Judiciary Committee used to bring the impeachment charges against President Clinton. Now, when that went to the Senate for the trial, if you want to call it a trial, the White House counsel, the president's lawyers, didn't get to see but about 6,000 pages of what was claimed to be about 60,000 pages of that evidence. If you're talking about a regular trial with regular folks, they would have and should have gotten to see all 60,000 pages of that information so that they could know who was bringing the charges, what their reliability was, what it was they were all saying, and so you could bring about an adequate defense. The fact that that the Congress, the House Republicans, got away with doing that to a president, and I'm in no way defending him or really speaking about, you know, taking a position on the impeachment process, but the fact that they got to do that to the president is really scary to me. It's scary to me because it's being used against other folks who don't have the visibility of the president.
Can you explain how it's being used?
Well, it's being used against just normal folks around the country, especially against immigrants. They are being people who are what's perceived as unpopular politics are being deported in various places around the country, and they're being deported not in the usual process where they get to stay out and have their jobs and live with their families, but they're being deported in a process where they are denied bond using secret evidence. So what that means is they go through a 2-3 however many year process from jail and accused of things that they don't know what they are. So they start out in this horrible position of being in jail, not knowing what the evidence is, not being able to rebut the accusers. And it's happening in our country, and it's been reauthorized in some ways by the Anti-Terrorism Act, although that's right now what's going on is happening under older law.
How does the Clinton Department of Justice fit into that?
Well, that's the ironic twist to all of this, is that it was the Clinton administration and the Justice Department now and the House Republicans and Democrats that authorized, that so firmly supported the Anti-Terrorism Act, that so firmly supported the use of secret evidence, that so clearly again raised and criminalized First Amendment activity where it has to do with particular political groups that are identified as being unpopular. So in some ways, this is a policy that's coming back to bite Clinton where he sits.
So how do you think people should organize now? I mean, you have President Clinton being the victim of this gathering of secret evidence that his own lawyers couldn't see, and then you see his own Justice Department using it. I mean, these are very different cases, but he certainly knows what it means to be charged and not being able to see some documents. How are you planning to organize at this point?
Well, we're trying to point out to the Justice Department and to the White House, which scream bloody murder about the use of secret evidence, as you pointed out, to again raise to them, as we've raised before, but now maybe they've seen some of the light in terms of this issue, that this is a fundamentally unfair process, that it shouldn't be done to immigrants, it shouldn't be done to citizens, and they have led the charge on this, but it's time for them to look again at this policy. So I'm hoping that this very personal reminder to the president will help stimulate what has been thus far a very moribund sense of civil liberties on his part and on the part of the Justice Department.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Kit Gage of the National Coalition to Protect Political Freedom. If people want to get in touch with your organization, is there a website you have or a phone number?
Sure, they could call 202-529-4225. This will only be brought about by lots of people around the country yelling about this issue, and I welcome your support on this.
Mm-hmm. And do you have a website?
Yep, it's www.ifconews.org/ncppf.html.
That's www.ifconews.org/ncppf.html. I want to thank you for being with us, Kit Gage. And you are. Thank you. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move on to our second subject today. A Brooklyn grand jury in New York last Thursday found several gun makers responsible in three shootings last week and awarded $500,000 to the survivor of one of the shootings, who was seriously wounded. This ended a closely watched lawsuit in which victims of gun violence and their family members accused gun manufacturers negligently manufacturing a lethal product. Although 15 of the companies were held responsible in the three shootings, another 10 were cleared, prompting both sides to claim victory. This case comes as cities across the country prepare to sue the gun industry to recover the costs of gun violence. So far, New Orleans, Miami, Atlanta, and Bridgeport, Connecticut have filed their suits, which ask for millions of dollars in compensation for medical and policing expenses related to gun violence. In an attempt to stop cities from suing, the National Rifle Association has mounted a lobbying campaign in state legislatures to have laws passed barring the cities from suing gun manufacturers. They've so far been successful in having laws passed in Georgia, although the city of Atlanta is defying the new legislation. We're going to go around the country right now to talk about the issue of these new gun trials that are taking place. And we're going to start with Paul Barrett, who is a writer for the Wall Street Journal. He has been covering these cases since even before the first lawsuit was filed. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Paul.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
Can you just lay out for us the background of what makes these lawsuits so unusual and what's the legal theory behind them?
These lawsuits are important and unusual because they grow out of the extraordinary litigation against the tobacco industry. Lawyers have looked at the experience with tobacco, in which state attorneys general en masse sued the industry, forcing it ultimately to come to the bargaining table and agree to a settlement. And they've decided that the same strategy can conceivably work with the gun industry. The theory here is similar to the theory that's being was used in a tobacco example, and that is that makers of products that cause tremendous social problems should be responsible for the costs that come along with those problems. In the case of tobacco, it was public medical costs. In the case of guns, the theory goes, it's the cost of policing the streets and picking up after the horrible violence associated with criminal use of guns. The case in Brooklyn that you referred to is a little bit different. That's not brought on behalf of a city, but brought on behalf of a group of individuals. Nevertheless, it's important and was trailblazing and also helped inspire these city lawsuits because it was the very first one to go to trial using a theory that the industry as a whole could be sued for its negligent marketing practices. The theory in particular was that the gun makers push more guns out onto the market, particularly certain parts of the market in the South, then are consumed by the legitimate buyers, and that the excess flow of guns end up in criminal hands and ultimately flow towards states like New York, causing problems on the streets. Of course, the industry has a very different view of all of this. The gun industry says that guns are quite different from cigarettes in one critical way, among others, and that is if you have a criminal killing, there's got to be a criminal pulling the trigger. The CEO of a gun company is not doing that. And the gun companies argue that we should not be held responsible for crime on the street any more readily than GM should be held responsible if someone gets into a Chevrolet drunk and knocks over an innocent pedestrian and kills that person. So that's the general lay of the land. And what's at stake is whether anti-gun activists can use the courts to force additional regulation or possibly significant money damages on an industry that has, in many ways, resisted many forms of regulation over the years.
Tina Johnstone is with us as well, who's co-founder of the Silent March, which each year collects the shoes of victims of gun violence and displays them all over the country. Her husband, John Johnstone, was killed by a 16-year-old while he was on a business trip in San Francisco, and she was one of the original plaintiffs in the Brooklyn, New York lawsuit, but her case was separated from the rest by the judge. Tina Johnstone, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Why was your case separated from the rest of the cases so that with the verdict that came down last Thursday, your case wasn't included?
Originally, the judge allowed only New York State residents. The victims, New York State residents, and then he changed his mind because our theory was so based on guns coming into New York State that the killing state, he said, should only be New York State. And my husband was a resident. He was of New York, and he was on a business trip in California, so the judge said our case had to be tried in California.
And how do you hold the gun manufacturers responsible for your husband's death?
They are responsible because they've created this environment in our country that makes handguns available to 16-year-olds and 15-year-olds and 14-year-olds. Kids aren't born with guns in their hands, and the gun manufacturers have so flooded our environment with guns that they're easily available to all kinds of people who don't have a legitimate access to them.
So where does your case go from here, since your case was not tried with the others?
I'm not quite sure. I'm going to let Elisa finish up completely with the Brooklyn case, and she will decide what to do about our case.
Your lawyer.
Yes.
Well, Tina Johnson, we're going to come back to you in a little while to talk about the novel activist approach you're taking with the silent march, collecting shoes and putting them on display around the country of gun victims. I remember months ago when you actually went to the gun industry, to the manufacturers, and you laid those shoes out. But I wanted to go right now to David Yaske, who is a professor of law at Brooklyn Law School, watching the Brooklyn case closely. What did you think was most significant about that?
Clearly, what was most significant was the finding by the jury that 15 major gun companies are negligent, careless in the way they sell guns. I just want to take issue with a couple of things Paul Barrett said. He said that this was about whether an industry that causes a lot of social harm should have to pay for the harm. It's not simply that guns cause a lot of harm. The arguments made in this lawsuit is that the gun companies are careless in the way they sell guns, that they could sell guns in a much more careful way that would result in less harm. So it's not enough to just say guns cause harm. You also have to show that the gun companies, there's something wrong with the way they're doing business. What was so important about this lawsuit was that the jury found that more than half the gun industry is careless in the way they sell guns.
Paul Barrett?
Well, I mean, that's absolutely a correct refinement. I wouldn't, and I'm happy to have the professor add the next level of detail to my comment.
Mm-hmm. What about the issue of whether, Professor Yaske, whether these gun activists are seeking a policy change?
Yeah, I don't think that's quite correct either. This isn't about trying to do legislation through law. These lawsuits are really an application of law that's been around for centuries. If you sell a product carelessly, negligently, then you're responsible for the harm it caused. And Paul, I think it's more than a minor clarification, because a lot of people look at these suits and they say, oh, what's next? You're going to sue ice cream companies because they have too much fat in the ice cream? And the answer is no. This is not like the gun company is not like other industries, because they take virtually no safety precautions in the way they sell a product, which is more dangerous than possibly any other product on the market. That's what the jury found. This was the first time that a jury was given a full, exhaustive, detailed case against the gun industry. And when they saw that, they found negligence.
Amy, it's very important to stress that while, yes, these particular actions are being fought out in a legal context in a courtroom, that substantial social agendas lie behind these lawsuits, These lawsuits are absolutely an extension of the anti-gun movement, for better or for worse, which it says nothing, of course, about my view on this issue. It would be naive to pretend that this is just another product liability case. While big business is certainly throwing out fairly far-fetched parades of horribles, such as, you know, as the professor says, potential suits against the ice cream industry or people who sell hamburgers, and that's probably off the map to the point of being silly. At the same time, there is a connection between these exceptional categories of litigation, whether it's against tobacco or against guns. These are very, very new, very different from a conventional lawsuit, even a conventional lawsuit having to do with a defective product, where there are thousands or even hundreds of thousands of plaintiffs. This suit in Brooklyn was very much the first of its kind, not a small step beyond what exists, but a big step.
Well, Paul Barrett of the Wall Street Journal and Professor David Yaske of Brooklyn Law School, we are also going to be joined when we come back from our break by a number of those people who are part of the anti-gun movement. We'll go to the Center to Prevent Handgun Violence, and we're going to head down to Louisiana to talk with the president of Louisiana Cease Fire about what these lawsuits mean for them. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Five cities have already sued gun makers: New Orleans, Chicago, Miami, Atlanta, and Bridgeport, Connecticut. Cities planning to file such lawsuits soon include Boston, Philadelphia, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Gary, Indiana. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, and we're looking at the scope of these lawsuits. We're joined by Paul Barrett of the Wall Street Journal, Professor David Yaske of the Brooklyn Law School, who's followed closely the Brooklyn case, which just came down with a decision last Thursday, where a jury found several gun makers responsible in three shootings last week and awarded $500,000 to a survivor of one of the shootings who was seriously wounded. We're also joined by John Lowy, who is staff attorney for the Legal Action Project at the Center to Prevent Handgun Violence in Washington, D.C. The center's co-counsel in a number of the lawsuits filed by cities, including New Orleans, Bridgeport, and Miami. John Lowy, welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Can you talk about these lawsuits around the country now and where they're standing? And I wanted to address a particular issue. One of the arguments being made is that manufacturers are concentrating on making their handguns more deadly rather than incorporating new safety devices.
Well, first of all, as far as where the lawsuits stand, they're at a very early stage. They've basically just been filed. We've not proceeded through discovery yet, so we've not received documents and information from the industry. As far as the second point, I think to pick up on the Hamilton case, the Brooklyn case that was just decided, one important fact that was established there was that a significant portion of the handgun market is the criminal market. And what the manufacturers have done is they have marketed and manufactured a product with that criminal market in mind. One expert in the Brooklyn case showed that 9mm semi-automatic pistols are particularly popular with criminals, and the production of those types of guns has gone up. what we have found in private lawsuits is that there are safety devices, which some have been around for over 100 years, and the gun industry has simply failed to implement them. So they've really shown that they have used their resources towards making guns more lethal, more concealable, and less safe for law-abiding citizens who want them for protection.
On the issue of oversupplying the market, can you explain, Paul Barrett was talking about it before, but this whole idea of sending in more guns to an area than you know it can handle. It saturates it, let's say South, which has lax gun laws, and you know then that others will take these guns and use them in other places.
Well, those facts, we've long known them, and they were established with some specificity in the Brooklyn case by expert analysis. In Florida, for instance, I believe the demand for handguns in Florida was something like 1.2 times the national average, yet the sales of handguns in Florida was over 2 times the national average. And they actually had testimony, or at least in the form of an affidavit, from a former Vice President Smith & Wesson, who said that the gun industry knows that its guns are going into the hands of criminals, and not from stolen guns, but from unsupervised sales that quickly come from the retail market into the hands of criminals. And also in the Chicago, City of Chicago lawsuit that you mentioned, undercover police proved that they would go into the suburban gun stores where handguns can be purchased, and they would make clear that they were residents of the City of Chicago where possession of handguns is prohibited. And gun dealers were very helpful in telling them how to get around the law and enabling these criminal possessions.
I wanted to go to the issue of police and guns and the increasing lethality of guns in police departments. It's a big issue in New York City right now. You have the killing of Amadou Diallo, who is the 22-year-old Guinean immigrant who was shot by police 41 times. And even with this and with their Glock semi-automatic weapons, they've just gotten approved this weekend hollow point bullets for police to use. I'm looking at an op-ed piece in the New York Times today by the former New York City Police Commissioner Raymond Kelly. And among the things he says is by the mid-1980s, the streets of most American urban centers were awash in narcotics, cash, and nines, or 9mm semi-automatic pistols that became the weapon of choice for drug dealers. Now, why I think this connects is that you've got this issue of these increasingly sophisticated weapons on the part of the police, and they say that they have to have these weapons in response to the increasingly sophisticated weapons on the part of criminals. Of course, Amadou Diallo doesn't fall into that category since he was not armed. But let me ask Professor Yaski, what is your response to this cycle and how that might fit into these lawsuits?
It absolutely does connect. I mean, this squarely poses the issue. The gun industry has continually argued that we're better off as a country if everybody has a gun and can defend himself or herself. I think that's plainly silly. And that if you weren't trying to sell as many guns as you could to make as much money as you could, nobody would consider that argument. The police, your argument is exactly correct. For years, the police had relatively low-level firearms. But when, in the 1980s, they found themselves confronted by young criminals with semi-automatic weapons with 30 and 40 round ammunition clips, the police were literally outgunned. And after you had a couple of police officers killed in confrontations with people with the superior weaponry, the police said, "We got to have the guns too." And how can you deny it to them? If they're facing these kind of guns on the street, it's very reasonable for them to ask for very high-powered weaponry themselves. The problem then is that when a police officer makes a mistake, and I don't know what the facts are of the Diallo case, maybe it was worse than a mistake, but when a police officer makes a mistake, it has much more horrible consequences if you're carrying a 9mm firearm with a 15-round clip.
I wanted to go down to New Orleans right now to Mark Foster, who's president of Louisiana Ceasefire, a public awareness group that does public education on the lethality of guns and is working against pro-gun legislation. Mark Foster, what is it like to take on the gun industry in Louisiana?
Well, it's quite overwhelming, especially here in Louisiana. We have a very pro-gun state here. And anytime we've tried to make a move toward any sort of gun legislation or make a move against pro-gun legislation, you have the NRA. They always send down their armies of lobbyists, you know, to invade our capital, and they have more money than you can imagine to spend on lobbying. So it's a daunting thing when you find yourself, you know, a small group of people trying to stand up against the NRA and just have the other side of the issue heard.
Well, the Louisiana governor has just announced he'll sign legislation barring cities from suing gun manufacturers, just like Georgia did. What will this mean?
I think it will mean, as far as I'm concerned, the power of the NRA is just illustrated once again. I'm a little amazed that they can just step right into a state and stop a civil action or a legal action by one of the cities. I just don't understand how a private group like this can wield such power. And here in Louisiana, I think it'll just be a matter of moments for this bill to pass through the House. I think it'll be one of the first things they consider when the legislature convenes in March.
Can I jump in?
Professor Yaski.
The distinction you're drawing between cities and states is quite interesting. Paul Barrett before said this is just like tobacco, where all the states all of a sudden started suing the tobacco industry. It's very interesting that so far not a single state has sued the gun industry. Only cities have. That's because in virtually every state in the country, when you talk about the whole state, the NRA is a very powerful force. In cities, where the gun violence problem is so severe, a mayor, an elected official, can get away with suing the gun industry. But when you go to the entire state, even in the what are thought of as the more liberal northeastern states, it's very dicey politics. Some people would think almost suicidal for a statewide official to take on the gun industry so directly. So that's one. The power of the gun industry is really actually a lot more powerful than the tobacco industry.
Paul Barrett of the Wall Street Journal. What is the significance of these states not, and have you seen any particular state possibly going the route of these cities?
The only state where it's been discussed, I think, with much emphasis actually is here in New York State, where the Attorney General has mused aloud about whether he would like to get involved in such a lawsuit. And I think the professor is correct that politics and culture would preclude most state-level officials from wanting to take the risk of getting involved with this. I mean, you can phrase it in an ominous way and say it's because of the gun industry's inappropriate degree of power, if that's what you believe. Or you could phrase it in a different way, which is that in many parts of the country, hunting and gun collecting are seen as legitimate, even healthy pursuits passed on from one generation to the next, so on and so forth. And people do not want to see their elected representatives basically going after what they consider to be a part of their way of life. But the bottom line is I think this will not primarily be a movement on the part of states. It will be a movement that will be driven by urban politicians who represent communities that are most immediately affected by, a lot of violence. One other note just to throw in here, and that is there is a certain irony to the atmosphere and timing of all of this. I myself am not 100% sure what to make of it, and that is these city lawsuits are coming to the fore right at a time when the horrendous violence statistics that we've all been so dismayed by in recent years are not disappearing, but the rate of increase is slowing, and sometimes in some categories, violent crime is dropping dramatically, which is something you can be sure the gun industry will use in its lobbying efforts to try to stamp out this litigation before it becomes a nationwide forest fire.
Tina Johnstone, as co-founder of the Silent March, which collects shoes of victims of gun violence and displays them in different areas this past year in front of the actual manufacturers of weapons, what has been the response?
We think we really want to educate the public about just exactly how many people die. It is, we have experienced reduced numbers of injury and deaths, but they are still, compared internationally, are outrageously high. And the cumulative effect, the public needs to know. We need to have, the majority of the public is in favor of different of gun control measures, but they are much less mobilized and much less vocal than the NRA. And
how many shoes do you put out there?
We put out, the last time we put out only the number of child deaths, and that was 5,285 pairs of shoes. That's how many were in front of Smith & Wesson in Springfield, Massachusetts.
And what was Smith & Wesson's response to all of these children's shoes in front of their property?
As usual, they say it's not our problem. It's criminal behavior problem.
John Lowy, the National Rifle Association has announced that it is getting deeply involved in these suits. We had a debate the other week between David Carries, one of the lawyers who's deeply involved in these lawsuits from Temple University, and the Second Amendment Foundation, which says it's going to be suing cities that sue the gun manufacturers. So where is all this headed right now?
Well, first of all, I don't understand what viable theory the gun industry or the NRA would have to counter-sue. I think that's a bluff and a scare tactic. The legislation that they are passing to prohibit the suits is more serious, even though I think there's a serious question as to whether these laws are constitutional. The law that was passed in Georgia recently, which basically singles out the gun industry as having special protection, I think that may have some serious constitutional problems. But these suits are going to continue to increase, I think, on the private side as well as the city side and perhaps states. I mean, this is an industry that has, through its political clout, has not had the regulation from the government that any other product maker in the country has. And they have been able to get away with tremendous havoc on our streets, and I think the American people are getting tired of it, and the Brooklyn case shows that juries are getting tired of the simple adage that guns don't kill people, people do. They realize that, well, there are a lot of people responsible for gun deaths.
Well, on that note, we have to wrap up, but I do want to give people a chance to get in touch with the different organizations represented here. If we could very quickly go around the circle, Tina Johnstone, the Silent March, how can people reach you?
We have a phone number that it's 516-247-9101.
That's 516-247-9101. John Lowy, staff attorney for the Legal Action Project at the Center to Prevent Handgun Violence in Washington, D.C.
Our phone number is 202-289-7319, and our website is handguncontrol.org.
That's 202-289-7319. And Mark Foster in Louisiana, Louisiana Ceasefire.
Our number is area code 225-346-8213.
One more time.
And I can get to
225-6-8213. 225-346.
225-346. 8213.
8213. I thank you very much for that, as well as Paul Barrett of the Wall Street Journal and Professor David Yaske of Brooklyn Law School. We'll continue to follow this story. You have been listening to Democracy Now!, which is produced by Maria Carrion with help from Stephanie Donnie. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. Joe Gill, engineered from Washington, D.C. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! From the studios of WBAI in New York.